So, you got another smart-ass comment, funny man?
Ricky glared at Slater.
I do not.
Good. Slater lowered the shotgun. Next time, I'll just pull the trigger, no warning, got it?
The rancher took a couple of steps away from the line and said in a loud voice,
We are going to walk out of here in a nice, obedient line. Anyone who causes a problem, walks too slow, weaves out of place, he looked at Ricky, opens his mouth, will immediately be removed and shot. Are there any questions?
There were none. Dylan activated his comm.
They just came out of the building. All six prisoners are chained together, like in one of those old prison movies. Yates and Slater are with them, plus three of their lapdogs.
He watched for a moment through his binoculars.
They're heading for the path to the meadow.
Copy, Ananga said. Go ahead and reposition.
Copy.
Eduardo glanced at the others in the line ahead of him as they were marched through the woods. He had no doubt they were being taken to their deaths, and there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. The chain holding him to the others prevented any chance of running away, but even if it hadn't been there, the weapons his captors held would take him down before he could move more than a few steps. But he would not give in to hopelessness. He had to believe there was still a chance of survival. Devon Rally held his arms out wide, like the ringmaster of a traveling circus who'd just introduced his main act. From out of the woods marched the prey for that night's festivities. Six unwanted members of society, chained together. The hunters eyed their soon-to-be quarry, each calculating which prey he should go after. The most skilled hunters, Mr. Wise and Mr. Reed, settled their gazes on the big white guy Slater had caught at the barn that day, while the least skilled, Mr. Hawks, seemed unable to decide between Tasha Patterson, the little Mex girl, and the older black guy. The prey were led onto the platform and told to face the hunters. Rally turned to the prisoners, and in a voice loud enough for everyone to hear, said,
Welcome to the Midnight Trials. In a few moments, your shackles will be removed, and the event will commence. I'm sure you are wondering what I mean by that. The trials are a tournament of sorts, a test of skills, if you will. These gentlemen, he gestured back at the hunters, have paid a great deal for the honor of participating. They are all skilled hunters, and you are to be their prey.
Rally took particular pleasure in this moment, that beat before his words were fully absorbed, followed by the realization of what was about to happen to them. The horror on their faces was electrifying. At most of the previous trials, all the prisoners displayed the same piss-in-their-pants expressions. Tonight, however, four did not react in the expected manner. Tasha Patterson looked as if she'd already given up, which was understandable. She'd been their guest for over 2 weeks now, and had been living the whole time with the realization things wouldn't end well for her. The Mex guy looked more pensive than fearful. Perhaps he was contemplating his demise, or planning to attack one of his captors. Most annoying, however, were the two intruders from that afternoon. They stared at Rally, their faces impassive. Rally's eyes narrowed. There was something familiar about the woman, but whatever it was, he couldn't place it, so he continued with the script.
You see the forest behind you? Go ahead, take a look.
All the prisoners looked over their shoulders, save the two intruders who continued to stare at Rally.
When you are given the signal, you will run into those woods. 3 minutes after you reach the trees, my friends behind me will...
It suddenly hit him. The woman was Caroline Cruz, Sean Raimi's assistant. Why had she broken into the barn?
We'll come looking for you.
Clearly, Cruz was not who she'd said she was, which meant there was a good chance Raimi wasn't either. But it didn't matter. Within a few hours at most, Cruz would be dead. As for Raimi, she needed to be eliminated in case she was involved. Rally would instruct Yates to make sure she would not see another sunrise either. With renewed strength, he said,
If you will please turn back around.
The prisoners did.
The good news is that somewhere in the woods is a way to freedom. I'm not saying it's easy to find, but if you do, your life will be yours again. As long as you never breathe a word of what happened here to anyone. If that happens, we will come for you and your family and everyone close to you.
Though there was still fear in several of the captives' eyes, Rally could see his words had given them hope. False hope, of course. There was no way out. The only freedom waiting for them would come from the business end of one of the hunter's weapons.
He looked at Slater.
Have the prey been ranked?
Yes, sir, Slater said.
Please reveal the rankings.
Slater went down the line, stopping in front of each prey to announce his or her difficulty level. The ugly Caucasian woman was proclaimed the sixth hardest, Tasha Patterson fifth, the black man fourth, the woman who went by the name Caroline Cruz third, the Mexican man second. The man who had been with Cruz at the barn was awarded the distinction of being judged hardest to kill, meaning whoever claimed him as a trophy would receive the Golden Mossberg. Raleigh turned back to his paying guests.
Gentlemen, if you will raise your rifles, we will now remove the prey's restraints. If anyone makes a move to get away or try to hurt one of the attendants, you are free to kill them here and now.
Raleigh then said to his cousins,
You may begin.
Liesl watched the meadow through the scope attached to her collapsible Accuracy International AWM sniper rifle. Devin Raleigh had arrived, and then the hunters assembled before him. Though Raleigh was facing away from her and too far away to hear, his hand gestures made it obvious he was giving a grandiose speech meant to inspire his guests. After a few minutes, the captives were led in. Liesl picked out Rosario, Ricky, and Tasha Patterson at the end of the line. When the hunters raised their rifles, she wondered if Keller had misled them and the prisoners were to be executed where they stood. But then Slater and Yates and a couple of their men began to unfasten the chains binding each captive. Once the chains were removed and Raleigh's people had stepped out of the way, Raleigh lifted an arm into the air. Liesl whispered into her comm,
Looks like things are about to start.
Copy, Ananka said. Dylan, you ready?
Ready.
Morgan?
Ready.
Gentlemen, prepare yourself. It is now time to start the midnight trials.
As Raleigh swung his arm down, he said,
Release the prey!
Slater, Yates, and several members of the youth brigade shouted, Run! Run! And get moving! And you stay, you die! It didn't take much prodding to get the captives racing toward the woods. Even the defiant intruders wasted no time hanging around. The moment the first of the runners reached the trees, Raleigh said,
The 3-minute countdown begins now. Release the prey!
Rosario grabbed Tasha by the arm and yelled, Come on! As she ran for the far end of the clearing. Sprinting beside them, Ricky said,
Some hills to the right. We should head that way.
Rosario saw the rise in the terrain.
Good idea!
While Ricky moved in front of the two women to lead the way, Rosario glanced over at the other prisoners who were fanning out to her left. The Latino guy was by far the best runner of that group and had already surged several yards ahead of the other two. Rosario, Ricky, and Tasha were pretty much keeping pace with him, though Tasha's strained breaths made Rosario unsure how long the woman could keep up.
We'll slow down when we get into the trees, she told Tasha.
Tasha managed only a nod. The Latino guy hit the woods first, followed by Rosario, Ricky, and Tasha seconds later, all painfully aware that in less than 3 minutes, the hunters would come looking for them. Liesl watched the prisoners spread across the meadow and race toward the woods where she was set up.
Rosario and Ricky are with Tasha, she reported. They will leave the meadow farthest east. The other three are each running alone. The first one to reach the forest will be a man, coming in 12 meters west of center point. The other two are about 1/2 minute behind him. One will enter right at the center, and the other 5 meters west of the first man.
Ananka adjusted her position based on Liesl's information and hunkered down again. She was in the woods approximately 100 feet from the meadow.
First one in the woods, Liesl announced.
A short pause.
Rosario, Ricky, and Tasha in.
The next pause lasted nearly 3 times as long.
The last two in.
Footsteps pounded the dirt, faint at first but growing louder by the second. Ananka raised her binoculars and scanned the area between her and the meadow. The body-sized heat signature of the first man flickered between trees.
Damn it, she said under her breath.
If he'd kept on the straight line he'd been on while crossing the meadow, he would have run right past her, but he was now on a diagonal path heading farther east, closer to where she'd been set up before. Her original idea was to grab him as he ran by, but there was no time to reposition, so she took off on an intercept course. Though the man was young and in decent shape, Ananka's superior conditioning allowed her to quickly narrow the gap, getting to within 25 feet of him before he realized she was there. He panicked when he saw her and increased his speed, changing direction again.
Slow down, she called. I'm not going to hurt you.
This only seemed to heighten his fear. Why should he believe her? He'd been told he'd be hunted and would perceive anyone as a threat. She raced after him, the chase taking her farther from where she was supposed to be. Dylan had been tasked with grabbing whichever captive entered the forest farthest to the east. This turned out to be the African-American man, who was obviously running out of energy. The moment he transitioned from the meadow into the woods, his all-out sprint turned into a staggering jog. By the time he neared Dylan, it couldn't even be called a jog anymore. Dylan was close enough that he simply reached out and wrapped his arm around the man's arms and chest.
"Hold on there, my friend," he said. The man tried to twist away but didn't have the strength.
When he realized this, he slumped in Dylan's grasp.
"Please, don't kill me. I'll do anything. Please, I'm not ready. I'm not ready."
"It's okay. It's okay. I'm not one of the bastards who want to shoot you. I'm actually here to make sure they don't."
The man blinked.
"I don't understand."
"Come on, we need to get you somewhere safe."
Suspicion clouded the man's vision.
"You're just going to take me to them, aren't you?"
"I'm not, but if I was, you're in no condition to stop me, are you?"
The man shook his head.
"All right then, the faster we get going, the faster you'll see I'm telling the truth."
Morgan heard the woman's staccato breathing before she heard the woman's steps. The captive's trajectory was west of Morgan's position, but not by much. Morgan eased behind a tree along the woman's path, waited until the captive was within 10 feet, and stepped out. The woman skidded to a stop across the needle-covered ground, her eyes wide.
"Don't worry," Morgan said. "I'm a police officer. I'm here to help."
"Police?"
The woman sounded as if she wanted to believe it, but wasn't sure she could.
"Yes, ma'am. We have the place surrounded. Nothing is going to happen to you, I promise."
You're really with the police?"
"I am."
The woman threw her arms around Morgan, crying,
"Oh, thank God! Oh, thank God!"
Morgan pulled herself free and put a supportive arm across the woman's back.
"This way."
Liesl was closest to where Rosario, Ricky, and Tasha entered the woods, but not close enough to signal them. Since she had an entirely different job to do, she silently wished them good luck and returned her eye to the rifle scope.
10 seconds, gentlemen," Raleigh said. "Remember, only one trophy per hunter."
He looked at his watch again.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, hunt.
"The gunmen have been released," Liesl announced. "ETA at the woods, 30 seconds.
"Copy," Dylan said. "I've got my man, and I'm en route to safe zone."
"Copy," Morgan said. "Me too."
A few seconds passed before Liesl said,
"Ananka?"
A couple of beats.
"I copy,"
Ananka said. "My target's being a little uncooperative, but don't wait for me, stick to the plan."
"Copy,"
Liesl said. She followed the hunters via her scope for a few seconds, and then looked back at the other end of the meadow, where Raleigh, Slater, Yates, and the men who weren't accompanying the hunters remained. Raleigh was talking to his cousins, waving one arm dramatically in Liesl's general direction. She memorized everyone's position and took her eye off the scope to check on the hunters' progress. They were approaching the woods only seconds away. She continued watching them until they disappeared. After double-checking that the suppressor was properly mounted, she nestled against the rifle stock, did a quick practice run, and reset to position one.
"I'm sure," Raleigh said, annoyed. "I just met her last night. Her name is Caroline Cruz. She was introduced to me as the assistant to Sean Ramey."
"Ramey?"
Slater said. "You know, the woman in town looking at locations for her company? The black one."
Raleigh nodded.
"Do you think they might be the feds?"
Yates said.
"Hell yes, I think they might be the feds,"
Raleigh said.
"That's why you need to get back to Bradbury and eliminate Ramey before she can cause us any more problems."
While Slater agreed the woman had to be dealt with, they needed to be smart about it. "After we bring her in and talk to her first."
"Bring her in?" Raleigh said. "Are you crazy?"
"Robbie," Slater said, "hear me out."
Slater had used Raleigh's childhood nickname on purpose, not only to get his attention, but as a subtle reminder that Slater was the oldest member of the family present.
"Cruz and Ramey obviously didn't come here alone," Slater continued. "Who knows how many more friends they have with them? The only way we're going to find out is to make Ramey tell us. Unless you want me to pause the trial and collect Cruz and her friend."
He knew full well Raleigh would never agree to removing a third of the prey from an active trial event.
Frustrated, Rowley said, "Okay, bring her in, but as soon as you get what you need, get rid of her." "No problem." Slater looked at his brother. "Do it." Yates nodded. "Give me 2 hours and I'll have her back here." "No," Rowley said, "not here. Take her to the..."
Without warning, Rowley pitched forward toward his cousins, screaming in pain. Slater caught him, and as he was lowering Rowley to the platform, Yates said, "Jesus, he's been shot!"
Rowley's knee had been ripped apart. The two brothers dove off the platform and then reached up and pulled Rowley down with them.
Their cousin's screams were joined by someone else's. Slater looked to his right and saw Joey Wilson rolling on the ground, his right pant leg torn and dark with blood. Rowley clutched his leg and continued howling. Slater knew if they didn't do something quick, their cousin would die of blood loss.
Slater removed the shoelace from one of Rowley's boots and gave it to his brother.
"Tie off his leg!"
Another person screamed, and another.
"Where are they shooting from?" Yates asked. "I don't hear anything."
"We need to get out of here," Rowley said.
A fifth wail, this one to their left. If they moved from behind the platform, Slater and Yates would be shot next. What they needed was a cover for their escape, and Slater knew just what that could be. He twisted around, looking for someone who could help. Most of his men lay in the field writhing, but then he spotted sandy blonde hair peeking over the benches in the observation area.
"Corey!"
he yelled. Corey Reese lifted his head enough to see over the bench.
"Mr. Slater, I thought they got you."
"Listen to me. Get the van from over by the cells and drive it out here."
"I don't have the keys."
Slater had already pulled the keys out of his pocket.
"Here,"
he said as he tossed them toward the benches. They landed with a jangle 5 feet shy of the tree line. Corey looked at them and back at Slater, clearly not wanting to go back into the meadow.
"Pick them up and get the van."
"Yes, sir."
When Corey moved out of view, Slater expected him to reappear seconds later at the edge of the trees nearest the keys, but the boy remained out of view. Behind Slater, Rowley moaned and seemed on the verge of passing out. He'd lost a lot of blood before Yates tied the leg off. They had medical supplies within the lodge, with plasma Rowley needed for a transfusion, but they didn't have the facilities or the expertise to deal with the minced meat that was once their cousin's knee, so ultimately they would need to take him somewhere that could deal with it, if he didn't die first.
"Corey! God damn it, where the hell are you?"
"I'm coming!"
Corey shouted. "Just a second!"
A few moments later, he appeared among the pines on his stomach, but instead of rushing out to grab the keys, he reached out with a large branch and tried to drag the keys to him. The tree trunk right above Corey's head exploded as a bullet slammed into it. To the kid's credit, it made him pause for only a second before he continued fishing for the keys. Another bullet hit the ground next to the branch, but Corey kept dragging. Though Slater couldn't see the keys, it appeared the boy was making progress. When they were within a foot or two of Corey, Slater yelled,
"Just grab him and go!"
Liesl swept the scope across the meadow. She'd disabled Rowley and all the young men who'd been holding rifles. That left only four. The woman who had disappeared into the woods, a young man off to the side near the benches, and Slater and Yates, pinned down behind the platform. She saw Slater toss a set of keys toward the remaining young man. No mystery there. They wanted a vehicle close so they could get away in a hurry. The only question was, which one would it be? She got a better look at the man when he started trying to drag the keys to him with a branch and realized man was a generous term. He couldn't be much more than 18. Though she could have easily taken him out, she aimed for the tree just above him to keep up appearances. She sent another shot into the dirt near the keys. The idea was to divide and subdue, so she wanted him to hurry. It would be great if she could take out Slater and Yates, but chances were the standoff would be prolonged, in which case many of the men she'd already taken down would die from lack of medical attention. The sooner the kid fishing for the keys got Slater and Yates out of there, the sooner she could do the bare minimum needed to keep the others alive. It wasn't so much an act of kindness as a desire not to lose a potential information source. When the man-boy leaned out from what he must have thought was the safety of the trees, she tilted the barrel ever so slightly and pulled the trigger. The ground a few feet in front of him erupted in a spray of dirt. The kid dove forward, grabbed the keys, and scrambled back into the woods. Liesl sent a final shot in his general direction to keep him on his toes, and then activated her mic.
"You were right, Dylan. They have sent one of their men for a car."
"Ha!" Dylan said. "I believe that means you owe me dinner."
Monica Slater, known during this month's trials as Miss Riefenstahl, ran through the woods. At first, she had no direction in mind except away from the meadow, but once she had some distance on the gunfire, she stopped to get her bearings. Her father had told her long ago that if anything ever went wrong, she was to get out of the situation as fast as she could and head back to their ranch. He'd made her promise that under no circumstances would she stay in harm's way. She glanced back toward the meadow, worried about him. She wanted to go back, see if he was all right, but he would be furious if she did. What she didn't have to do was hike all the way back to the lodge. There were ATVs sitting unused near the building with the holding cells. She veered to the west, avoiding the main trail, and hurried over the small ridge down to where the vehicles were parked. As she started to climb onto one of the ATVs, an Irishman's voice said behind her, "Beautiful night, isn't it?" 32. Eduardo was under no delusion that an escape route out of hell actually existed. What he did know was that the people who'd taken him and the others were insane. Hunting people? How could that not be crazy? So there might not be a real escape route, but he knew the longer he avoided the hunters, the better his chance of finding a way out of this. As plans went, it was light on details, but better than just rolling over and letting them kill him. He'd worked all of this out on the sprint from the platform to the woods. Seconds later, when a woman came out of nowhere to chase him, everything flew from his mind except running for his life. He had no doubt she was part of the setup, there to slow him down. Her words to the contrary were so transparent he dismissed them immediately. Racing through the dark forest, he thought he'd be able to lose her. He'd always been a good runner, and she looked older than he was, so she should have quickly fallen behind. But not only did she keep pace with him, his multiple directional changes never threw her off. He scanned ahead for anything that might assist his escape. When he saw a patch of trees and brush thicker than the area surrounding it, he decided to turn behind it. If he could use the cover to double back and throw her off, he would be in the clear. When he rounded the trees, he realized he'd lucked onto something even better than he'd hoped. The growth had been hiding a stream bed sunk into a 10-yard-wide mini-arroyo, the bottom a good 4 to 5 feet below ground level. He jumped over the side and landed on the bank. He'd seen enough movies to know that the way to throw off a tracker was to obscure one's trail in a river, so he ran into the water. After a few steps, though, he realized he had a bigger problem. While he wasn't leaving any visible steps behind, the water sloshing was just as much a giveaway of his whereabouts. He swung left and right, looking for some other solution. There. The near-vertical walls of the arroyo twisted and turned, creating dozens of little nooks. Hoping one was large enough for him to hide in, he hopped onto a slab of rock that stretched all the way to the wall and rushed toward the nearest crevasse. Ananka lost the man she was chasing when he made a hard turn to the right into a thick stand of trees. When she reached the point where he'd disappeared, she discovered trees had been hiding a creek flowing down a ravine. The man's footprints showed he'd jumped into the depression, so she followed. She found a few more steps along the creek's bank, and then nothing. If the guy had used the water to cover his trail, then she either should have heard splashing or been able to see him, because he would have had to move slowly to mitigate any sound. She spun around. Though only about 5 feet high, the side of the ravine undulated like a twisting ribbon set on edge. Some of the crags looked large enough to hide in, but there were no footprints in the bank leading to them. She scanned along the stream and smiled. About 10 feet farther down, a slab of half-buried rock extended from inside the water all the way to the ravine's edge, and on it, water spots in the distinct pattern of steps. The wet footprints continued a good 2/3 of the way toward the wall, decreasing in intensity the farther from the stream they went, until the last were barely visible. She studied the wall and counted at least 4 different recesses in which the man could be hiding. "Just come on out," she said. "I swear I'm not going to hurt you. I'm here to help." She cocked her head, listening for movement. Only silence. She took a step toward the wall. "The last thing I want is for those assholes to put a bullet in you, but that's exactly what's going to happen if I don't get you someplace safe in a hurry." Still nothing. Damn it. Guessing he was in one of the 2 recesses closest to the rock slab, she moved another few steps toward them. "Listen, if I wanted to kill you, don't you think I would have shot you when we were running? The answer is yes, I would have, and I could have done it 12 times, but I didn't." The babble of the creek, but nothing else. "Seriously, buddy, we're running out of time here." Eduardo had been hoping to hear the woman splashing down the stream away from him, and though he did hear a few watery steps, they soon fell silent. He could see nothing from the nook he slipped into, and had no idea what she was doing.
"Stay calm, she'll be gone soon enough."
"Come on out, I'm not going to hurt you."
His breath caught in his throat. She hadn't left, and was in fact close to the wall of the arroyo.
She tried tricking him again with her words, but he still wasn't buying it. He heard her take another few steps closer before she pleaded with him again. Seriously, buddy, we're running out of time here. On that point, he agreed. The other hunters were still out there, and every second he remained in the same spot, they gained ground. The woman stepped forward again, giving him a much better idea of where she was. He still had a chance, he realized. He took a deep, quiet breath and then eased toward the alcove's entrance. Ananka was only 5 feet from a wall now, the entrance to one crag directly in front of her and the other a few feet to her left. She took a careful step forward, not wanting to make any noise, and then leaned a little to the right to peek inside the niche. Empty. She moved to the left and leaned forward to look inside the other crag. Eduardo stepped to the very edge of his nook and peeked out. The woman was about 10 feet away, her back to him. He slipped out of his hiding place and sneaked down the riverbank away from her. His stealth mode lasted only a few steps before his fear got the better of him, and he began running down the side of the stream. The interior of the niche was coming into view when Ananka heard someone running behind her. She spun around and saw the man racing away from her. Oh, come on! She took off after him. Though the side of the ravine where they jumped down was too steep to easily climb back up, the man found a gentler slope a dozen yards farther on and was soon back at the forest ground level. Ananka huffed up the side, worried she might lose him again, but there he was racing through the trees in the most dangerous direction he could have taken. No, not that way! Eduardo ran out of the arroyo and into the woods. Without stopping, he looked around and tried to figure out which way to go. The stream had bent a bit, hadn't it? He thought so, but wasn't sure. Nor was he sure if he was heading toward the meadow or away from it. Behind him, he heard the woman reach the top of the ravine. No! She yelled. Not that way! He lost a step, wondering if she was right, until he reminded himself her job was to trick him. The days in the trailer behind the semi-truck, the drugs they'd given him to keep him knocked out, the sheer disbelief when he learned why he and the others had been brought there, and the constant running since then had turned his mind into mush. The only thing he knew for sure was that if he stopped, he would die. Ananka had to admire the guy's determination to live, but since her warning had done nothing to change his direction, that same determination was going to get him killed. Somewhere beyond the man, she heard the snap of a branch. Oh, crap. One or more of the hunters were closing in, or worse, waiting for the runner to come to them. Ananka hit her afterburners and all but flew between the trees. Mr. Houston knelt behind the fallen tree, his crossbow propped on the trunk. You're in perfect position, his observer whispered. The man looked at the handheld tablet that tracked the prey's location. Mr. Houston scanned the woods through the scope. It wasn't true night vision. That would provide too much advantage, he'd been told. But it did have heightened nighttime abilities, so he was able to partially make out the landscape as far as 150 feet away. Nothing was moving out there yet. He should be about 5 degrees right of straight ahead, the observer said. Mr. Houston adjusted his aim. Any second now. Eduardo heard the woman gaining ground. He tried to increase his speed, but he had nothing more to give. Keeping his head down, he pressed on, knowing he was unlikely to live through the next few minutes. Ananka was so close now she could hear the man's panicked breaths. She looked past him for any sign of hunters, but all she could see were trees and more trees. They had to be there somewhere, which meant there was no more time. She closed the gap and launched herself forward. 165 yards, the observer said. 160, 155. Mr. Houston saw movement at the far edge of his vision, man-shaped. Before the observer could update the distance, Mr. Houston pulled the trigger, letting the bolt fly. Eduardo had a moment of confusion when the sound of the woman's steps suddenly stopped. He started to look over his shoulder to see what had happened when Ananka slammed into the man's back, knocking both of them to the ground, her on top. Before the guy could react, she heard something whiz over their heads, thwacking into a tree. She looked back and saw a crossbow bolt protruding from a trunk. The man struggled under her. Stay down, she whispered. Let me up! Do you want to die that much? Because there's a guy out there with a crossbow who is more than willing to help you with that. And if you don't believe me, look. She twisted his head a little so he could see the tree that had been hit. That whitish thing sticking out of the trunk? That's called a bolt, and I'm pretty sure he doesn't have just one.
Do you believe me now?
He looked confused.
Who are you?
I'm the woman who's going to save your life.
I got him, Mr. Houston declared. Did you see that? I got him.
The target is down, the observer said.
I know, I got him.
Mr. Houston looked through his scope at the shadowy hump on the ground. It moved a little, but showed no signs of getting up again.
I think he's still alive.
May I see? Mr. Houston handed the bow to the observer. The young man sighted downfield.
You're right. Would you like to finish it off, or let it bleed out? I'm here to hunt, not sit around.
The observer handed him back the crossbow.
Then let's go do it.
Ananka saw two silhouettes emerge from the woods and head in their direction.
You're not going to like this, but I need you to do something, she whispered.
What? She told him.
No way! Let me up! I'd rather run!
Your way will get you killed. My way won't.
Are you crazy? Of course it will!
That's fine. You don't need to believe me. She checked the two hunters. But you're smart enough to know if you try to run now, they'll kill you before you reach safety. The man looked toward the silhouettes and cursed.
So, do you want my help, or should I leave you to deal with them yourself? She asked.
He took another peek at the approaching hunters and whispered,
Help me.
Good. Stay right here and don't move or make a sound. She slipped off him and belly crawled into the bushes a few feet away. The dark lump of downed prey seemed to be writhing on the ground as Mr. Houston and his observer began their hike across the field. They were nearing the midpoint when the trophy appeared to roll onto its back and lose half its height. Mr. Houston paused, waiting to see if the prey was preparing to attempt an escape, but the shadow stopped moving. He grinned. Perhaps his initial shot had been enough and the trophy was dead. One shot, one kill. That sounded pretty damn good. Mr. Houston bet few of his fellow hunters were that skilled. They were about 30 feet away when Mr. Houston began to see details in the shadow. It was one of the male targets. Maybe Mr. Houston had just won himself the Golden Mossberg. But then he realized the man on the ground was too small to be the guy ranked most difficult. Probably the Hispanic guy, who'd been number two. That was nothing to sneeze at. Mr. Houston crept forward, his crossbow raised in case the prey was playing possum. Movement. The prey's chest. Up and down. Up and down. Mr. Houston frowned. So much for a one-shot kill. It would have to be two. He sighted down his weapon. Ananka watched the hunters approach. There appeared to be only two, a balding middle-aged guy holding a crossbow and one of the young lookalikes. She let them come closer in case others might reveal themselves. None did. She took a breath, let it halfway out, and held. Eduardo heard the crunch of pine needles under the approaching steps. His pursuers were close, way too close. What was the woman doing? She'd said she would help him.
She was never here to help you.
The voice in his head sucked away the last of his hope. As he'd assumed at the start, she had only meant to make him an easier target. Another crunch, no more than 10 feet away. He braced himself for the inevitable. Thup. Mr. Houston aimed at the trophy's head and prepared to pull the trigger. Pain exploded from his left leg. He screamed and fell to the side, the bow dropping near his feet. The moment he hit the ground, he heard another scream and saw his observer go down. Mr. Houston felt along his leg. His pants were torn apart, and underneath was a gooey mess of tissue where his knee should have been. He tried to roll so that his knee wasn't on the ground, but stopped when something hard smashed into his ribs.
How do you like that, asshole?
The prey glared down at him, looking as if he hadn't been struck by the bolt at all. The next kick caught Mr. Houston in the cheek, rocking his head to the side.
Does that feel good?
The prey said, clearly winding up for another strike. Before he could lash out again, a calm but commanding female voice said, That's enough.
This pendejo is going to kill me,
the man Ananka had rescued said. He was, but he's not now.
He wanted me dead. I want him dead.
Understandable, but let's let him suffer for a little while first, shall we? The guy's chest heaved up and down with rage, but eventually his breath slowed, and he took a step back without delivering another kick. What's your name? She asked. A hesitation.
Eduardo.
Ananka pulled out several heavy-duty zip ties from her bag and held out a few to him.
Do you know how these work, Eduardo?
Sure. Good. Take them. She nodded at the younger guy she'd shot.
secure his hands behind his back and tie his ankles together, then use a couple to create a tourniquet on his thigh above the wound. Eduardo gawked at her.
Why would you want them to live?
Let me ask you a question. Do you know how far this operation spreads? Because if you do, then please, by all means, stomp their heads into the ground. If not, wouldn't it make more sense to keep them alive until we know who knows what? Eduardo glanced away.
Damn, Ananka said. I guess that means you don't know.
Looks like you're going to have to tie him up. While Eduardo worked on the younger guy on the ground, Ananka knelt next to the older man, the hunter.
How's that leg feeling?
He muttered something under his breath. I'm going to tie off your leg so you don't bleed to death. That sound like a good idea to you? He blinked.
Yes, tie it. Don't let me die.
She connected three ties together and created a loop around his thigh. He winced as she tightened it.
You should still have enough blood in you to keep going, she said, smiling. Of course, the shock might kill you. Sorry.
With Eduardo's help, she dragged both men to separate trees and used more zip ties to secure them to the trunks.
Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure, she said.
She started to turn away, but then stopped. It'll probably be a while before anyone gets out this way to collect you, which means, at best, you're likely going to lose those legs. Something to think about and start adjusting to while you wait. She looked at Eduardo. You want to stay alive? Follow me. She headed into the woods.
33. Mr. Wise, Mr. Reed, and Mr. Wells moved through the woods with their observers in a north-northeasterly direction. They had not planned on traveling together, but both Mr. Wise and Mr. Reed had marked the big Caucasian guy as their target. Mr. Wells, ever the opportunist, had watched the big guy stay with the two women when they ran for the woods, so he felt confident the two other hunters would lead him to at least one potential trophy. And who knew? Maybe he'd get lucky and bag the number one prey himself. Mr. Wise and Mr. Reed seemed to have silently declared a temporary detente and were working together to find the prey. Since they were superior trackers, Mr. Wells let them lead but stayed right behind them. Mr. Reed let out a low double hiss before waving everyone in his direction. At his feet, a spotty line of disturbed ground cover ran to the north.
Is it fresh? Mr. Wells asked.
Mr. Wise and Mr. Reed looked at him as if he was an idiot and then started along the trail without saying a word. Apparently, it was fresh. Assholes. The tracks went nearly 200 yards before they disappeared. The men searched around, trying to pick them up again, but the ground in the immediate vicinity revealed nothing.
We should split up and look farther out, Mr. Reed suggested. We can meet back here in 10 minutes.
Right, Mr. Wise said. Then you find something and keep going while we wait here for you to return.
I give you my word,
Mr. Wise snorted.
Maybe we should search together, Mr. Wells said.
That'll waste too much time, Mr. Reed said.
More time than standing here arguing about how we should do it?
Mr. Reed didn't look happy, but said,
Fine.
Ricky, Rosario, and Tasha's immediate goal was to put as much distance between themselves and the meadow as fast as they could. Unfortunately, they weren't far into the woods when it became clear Tasha wouldn't be able to keep up for much longer. Easing back a bit, Ricky slung an arm around Tasha's back to help her, while Rosario took over at point. Knowing they were leaving a clear trail, but unable to do much about it, they continued into the woods for nearly 10 minutes before Rosario stopped and pointed to their right.
Look!
A rocky ridge poked above the treetops about 50 yards away. High ground. Ricky said,
I like it.
Instead of immediately heading toward it, Rosario studied the surrounding area before saying to Tasha,
Watch me carefully. Light steps along the same path I take.
Tasha nodded, looking too tired to say anything. Rosario picked her way around the spots where the pine needles were densest and avoided all dead branches and anything else that might leave a sign of their passing. By the time they reached the top of the ridge, she was confident they'd left little to no tracks. They climbed through the rocks and stopped just on the other side.
You can rest here, Rosario told Tasha.
Tasha leaned against one of the boulders.
They're still going to be able to find us, Ricky said, and tapped his shoulder where it met his neck.
Rosario looked at him, confused.
Trackers, he said. We've all got them.
She touched her own neck. The skin was tender, something she would have noticed sooner if she hadn't had other things to worry about. Underneath, she could feel the tracking bug. Her anger, already high, flared. To Ricky, she said,
See if anyone is following us.
While he snuck up between two of the rocks,
She searched the ground, picking up stones and setting them down again when she found something better. Her final selection had a corner that came to a point and a somewhat tapered edge. It wasn't perfect, but it should do the job. She sat on a rock and moved her finger over the spot where the bug had been implanted. The device was the size of a small ball bearing and about a quarter inch below the surface. Using the rock, she dug into her skin, creating a slit half an inch long. Since the bug had been put in only that afternoon, the path it had carved through her tissue hadn't had time to heal, and she was able to quickly work the ball out of the slit. As she dropped it into her palm, she felt Tasha's eyes on her.
"That's in me, too?" Tasha asked. "Apparently."
Tasha scratched her own neck until she found the bug. She hurried over to Rosario, her head cocked to the side.
"Get it out! Please get it out!"
"It's going to hurt.
I don't care. Get it out!"
Ricky crawled back down the rocks as Rosario finished up operating on Tasha.
"They're down there around where we stopped running," he whispered before he noticed what Rosario was doing. Is that thing sterile?"
"Sit down and shut up," Rosario said. "You are next." Mr. Wise, Mr. Reed, and Mr. Wells completed an arc of approximately 180 degrees without finding any signs of the prey.
"We do it again," Mr. Reed said, "wider."
"Wait a second," Mr. Wells said. "How do we know we're not wasting time? Maybe they went the other way."
"This is a hunt," Mr. Wise said. "This is how you do it."
"Maybe that's how you do it," Mr. Wells said. He hadn't made his fortune by always sticking to the rules. He walked over to the observers. "You guys know where they are, don't you?"
After the young men exchanged looks, the one assigned to Mr. Wells said,
"Of course."
"Then which way do we need to go?"
"We can't tell you that."
"Okay. Can you at least tell us if we're spinning our wheels here? I mean, none of us want to waste time looking for things that aren't there, right?"
The observers huddled for a moment of hushed conversation. Then Mr. Wells's observer said, "You are not spinning your wheels."
"Good. Thanks for that. No hints on direction, though?"
"No."
Mr. Wells grinned. "I'm a good tipper."
While his observer replied, "I'm sorry, Mr. Wells, but as you know, those are the rules."
His colleague at the back, Mr. Reed's observer, locked eyes with Mr. Wells and purposefully moved his gaze to the right and turned his head a little. And then he did it again. Another smile from Mr. Wells.
"No problem. I understand."
As he headed back to his fellow hunters, he glanced in the direction Mr. Reed's observer had indicated and spotted a ridge of rocks through the trees.
"Gentlemen, if you'll follow me."
"This looks like a good spot," Ricky said.
They'd hiked about 75 feet farther north along the ridge. Rosario scanned the area.
"I agree."
She tossed the trackers into a bush.
Mr. Wells led his reluctant colleagues up the slope to the top of the ridge, pausing right before the crest. He glanced back at the others, pretending to check their positions, when in reality he was looking for Mr. Reed's observer. The man checked his tracking tablet, then nodded to the left and held his thumb and forefinger close together. Mr. Wells acted like he was listening for a few seconds.
"Did you hear that?"
Mr. Wise and Mr. Reed looked unsure.
"Yeah, footsteps," Mr. Wells said, his head cocked. "Up the other side a ways, I think."
He took them over the apex and followed the ridge to the north. Additional check-ins with his observer in crime homed him in on the spot where the prey should be. As Mr. Wells raised his Mossberg and prepared to creep forward, Mr. Reed grabbed his shoulder and shoved past him. Mr. Wise tried to do the same, but Mr. Wells stuck out a well-timed elbow and held on to second position. The men stepped around the rock with their weapons up, ready to claim their prizes. No one was there. Though Mr. Wise and Mr. Reed were disappointed, they didn't share Mr. Wells's surprise since they hadn't possessed the information indicating this was the spot. Mr. Reed continued north along the rocks. As they rounded a big boulder, Mr. Wise attempted to pass Mr. Wells again. This time, Mr. Wells didn't put up a fight. He was more interested in finding out why the observer had led him astray. He paused, as if to catch his breath. Mr. Wise's observer came around the big rock next, and Mr. Wells's man followed. Mr. Reed's, however, did not appear.
"Where's your friend?"
Mr. Wells said to his observer. The guy looked around.
"He was right behind me."
They waited for a few moments, but when the third man still didn't show up, Mr. Wells's observer said,
"I'll go check on him."
He headed back the way they'd come. Mr. Wells grimaced. He knew what had happened. The missing observer had been feeding him bad info and was now trying to avoid a confrontation.
"No tip for you, asshole." Mr. Wells waited a moment longer, but when neither observer returned, he decided it was time to catch up with the others. He didn't want to miss his opportunity for the kill. Rosario lay the unconscious kid next to the first one. Like his friend, this one had a pistol and computer tablet. Before Ricky left, she'd given him the other guy's weapon. She took this one and continued her pursuit. The six-man hunting team was now down to four. An outcropping of rock blocked their path, forcing Mr. Reed to lead the others down the slope a bit to move around it. As they hiked back to the summit, he glanced over his shoulder. Mr. Wise was right behind him. The man was the closest thing Mr. Reed had to a competitor. Mr. Reed, however, had no intention of letting Mr. Wise claim the ultimate prize. A dozen feet behind Mr. Wise came the opportunist Mr. Wells. While the man wasn't even close to being in the same league as Mr. Reed and Mr. Wise, the bastard could get lucky. The observers were apparently much farther back, as none of them had come around the low end of the outcropping yet. A crunch. Mr. Reed whipped his head back around. It had sounded like something pushing down on pine needles just on the other side of the rocks. Crouching, he quietly approached the ridge. The rock face directly in front of him was too steep to climb, but a little farther on, the surface was broken into a dozen smaller chunks he could use to scale the formation. He ascended to right below the top, then raised his head to peek down the other side. Rosario stood with her back against a tree, as if she were part of the pine itself. The last of the three younger men had finally noticed his friends were missing. He paused near the low end of the rocky spur the hunters had just gone around, looking back the way he'd come. For a moment, he seemed torn on which way to go, but his concern about his buddies won the day. He hiked right by her position, not even glancing at the tree, allowing her to easily slip in behind him and smash him on the side of his head with her pistol. Three down, three remaining. Another crunch, this time from the woods just beyond where the rocks ended. Mr. Reed brought his crossbow around and looked through the scope. Someone was there, hidden by the trees. His gut tingled in excitement. This was it. The moment of closing in that would culminate in the bagging of his trophy. Mr. Wise crept up beside him and peeked over the rocks. "Where?" he whispered.
"Not sure," Mr. Reed told him. "Might have been an animal."
"They're all animals, aren't they?"
"True."
Mr. Reed looked down the ridge for a good place to make a quiet descent. A fissure between boulders about 10 feet to the right looked to be the best choice. He wished he could take it without Mr. Wise following, but that wasn't going to happen. It looked like winning would come down to who was the better shot, which, of course, he was. He moved sideways across the rocks to the fissure and slipped into it without raising his head above the ridge. Mr. Wise stayed right behind him. Mr. Wells waited at the bottom of the rocks while the other two hunters climbed to the top and looked over. No reason to waste energy. When the two men moved sideways and disappeared into a crack, however, he knew it was time to get going. He started scaling the rocks. Mr. Reed reached the bottom and slowly stepped out of the fissure. Trees where the noise had come from were about 10 yards away. All was quiet now, which made him think the prey was hunkered down, hiding. He pulled his crossbow up again, holding it rib high so he could get off a quick bolt if necessary, or raise it to his shoulder for a more accurate shot if he had the time. As he stepped toward the trees, he heard Mr. Wise exiting the fissure behind him. Another step, then...
"Drop the bows, boys."
Both Mr. Reed and Mr. Wise jerked in surprise and turned to the voice. One of the prey stood behind them, shielded by a chest-high slab of rock. The big guy, the ultimate prize. At the same moment Mr. Reed saw Mr. Wise adjust the aim of his crossbow, he realized the prey was holding a pistol. A gunshot echoed off the rocks before Mr. Wise could let his bolt fly. The man dropped to the ground, a bullet hole in the center of his forehead. Mr. Reed stared, wondering how in God's name the prey had obtained a weapon.
"I did warn him," the prey said. "Are you going to try to shoot me too?"
If Mr. Reed pulled his trigger now, the bolt would slam harmlessly into the rock. But if he tried to readjust, he'd suffer the same fate as Mr. Wise. What he needed to do was buy time until Mr. Wells and the observers could do something. The gunshot would have alerted them, and Mr. Reed was sure they were getting into positions to take out the prey.
"I believe I said drop it," the prey said.
Mr. Reed lowered the bow and let it gently fall to prevent any major damage. He'd need the weapon again soon enough.
"Take 3 steps back, the prey said. After Mr. Reed did as asked, the prey came around the rock and picked up the crossbow. "This is sweet,"
the man said as he examined the weapon. He set his pistol on a rock surface and pointed the crossbow at Mr. Reed.
So tell me, how does this feel?
Mr. Reed took a breath.
Where the hell is everyone?
Not too good, does it? The prey said. Mr. Reed shook his head, shooting a sideways glance at the rocks.
Bad news, my friend, the prey said. Your hunting partners aren't going to rescue you.
Though the big man didn't look like he was bluffing, he had to be. The two women he'd been with couldn't have taken out the other four on Mr. Reed's team. That idea was ludicrous.
I have to say, I admire that you came after me, with my ranking as most difficult.
The prey grinned.
Clearly it was well-deserved, wouldn't you say?
I am just a guest here, Mr. Reed said. I did not realize when I came what was going to happen.
Ooh, the prey winced. Really? You're going straight for the blame others defense? That's pretty crappy. And to be honest, makes me hate you just a little more.
Mr. Reed heard a scrape in the rocks behind him. Finally, with renewed hope, he said,
No, no, I was not going to shoot you. I was going to stop the others from doing so.
You're saying you would have shot your friend there and not me?
A step this time, definitely a step. Trying to keep the smile off his face, Mr. Reed said,
Yes, exactly. Now that is funny.
Mr. Wells had pulled himself up to the crack and started to lower himself inside when he heard the gunshot. He paused, surprised. Though Mr. Reed and Mr. Wise were carrying pistols, they had both made clear their weapons of choice were their crossbows. Obviously, one of them decided to use the easier weapon. But as Mr. Wells took his first step down, he heard someone say,
Are you going to try to shoot me too?
The voice did not belong to Mr. Reed or Mr. Wise. Mr. Wells stretched forward and sneaked a peek around the edge of the fissure and down into the area below. A man he was pretty sure was Mr. Reed was standing still. It took a moment before Mr. Wells noticed Mr. Wise lying on the ground, his crossbow beside him.
I believe I said drop it.
Mr. Wells followed the sound of the voice and spotted the large prey, half hidden by a rock, pointing a pistol at Mr. Reed. Mr. Wells pulled back inside the crack. The prey was armed?
Oh, shit! Oh, shit! Oh, shit!
Mr. Wells knew he could get a shot off if he propped his back against the side of the crack, but was less confident about his ability to hit the mark. The way he figured it, his shot would miss, the prey would kill Mr. Reed and then come after him.
Nope, this is not what I paid for.
The observer should take care of this, not him. He climbed back up the crack and pulled himself onto the rock on the other side.
Hello?
He leaped backward at the sound of the woman's voice, an unfortunate reaction, considering his location. Right before he tumbled down the side, he caught sight of her. It was the small prey, the Hispanic, crouching next to the crack. He'd hoped she'd be his trophy. As he fell, she waved. The first few hits against the rock broke his arm and at least two ribs. Then, three-quarters of the way down, his head slammed into the surface, not quite blacking out the world, but close. It was his neck breaking when he reached the bottom that accomplished that mission. Ricky had heard the sounds behind the hunter, too. He had also seen Rosario stick her head out from the break in the rocks and give him a thumbs up. The hunter clearly was expecting reinforcements. Ricky let him live in his delusion for a few moments longer.
So how are you going to explain killing your friends and not us? I mean, I gotta think the assholes who run this place probably wouldn't have liked that. It does not matter. It would have been the correct thing to do.
Rosario eased out from the fault.
If that's so, you are way more noble than I gave you credit for,
Ricky said. The hunter attempted to look self-effacing.
It is no more than anyone would have done. Everything else wrapped up?
The hunter looked unsure how to answer, but that was because the question wasn't for him.
One dead, and three who won't be waking up for a while,
Rosario said as she moved around the hunter to join Ricky. Ricky focused back on the now pale man.
Did you really think you'd get away with hunting people? With hunting us? I told you,
Ricky pulled the trigger. He and Rosario relieved the two dead hunters of their remaining weapons before rejoining Tasha where they'd left her to wait. The Scalarian CFO eyed the guns and crossbows.
We're okay?
We are okay,
Rosario said.
What now?
Rosario and Ricky shared a look.
Rosario said, We help the others, if they are still alive. Then we get you out of here.
34. Dylan lay on the roof of the building where the holding cells were, looking through his binoculars. He scanned the area between where the vehicles were parked on the side and the woods back toward the meadow where the trials began. It was only a short wait before the silhouette of Slater's man separated from the trees and sprinted across the open ground to the van. Dylan clicked his mic twice to let the others know the guy had arrived. He could have easily taken this kid out, but his gun remained at his side as he watched the guy rush up to the vehicle and jump into the driver's seat. When the engine started, Dylan said, "Prepare to reposition."
"Copy," Morgan said.
She was really getting the hang of things. Dylan was off the roof and ready before the van started moving. There was a chance the guy would decide to screw his bosses over and head for safety. If that was the case, they would let him go. But scared as the kid probably was, he was also well-trained as he headed for the path toward the meadow.
"Coming your way, Liesl." "Copy."
Dylan moved to the hidden spot he'd picked out earlier, close to where the path to the meadow exited the trees.
"In position. Morgan?"
"In position."
He glanced toward the eroded ditch she would be in. He couldn't see her, but that was the point.
"Liesl?"
he asked. Liesl eyed the opening to the path via the rifle scope.
"He has paused just inside the trees."
It didn't take a lot of thought to know the driver was scared of getting shot. The irony was, she could shoot him dead where he was sitting right now. Though she couldn't see Rally, Slater, or Yates hiding behind the platform, she did hear one of them yelling. Since it was all anger and no pain, she figured it was one of the brothers, urging the guy in the van to get his ass in gear. It took a second shout to finally get the vehicle moving. It crept forward, but as soon as the front bumper cleared the trees, the driver slammed on the accelerator. The van raced onto the field, took a sharp right turn that nearly toppled it, and skidded to a stop on Liesl's side of the platform.
"Loading now," she said.
The moment the van stopped, Slater and Yates hauled their cousin up between them. Rally was barely conscious. Slater thought they'd stopped the bleeding in time, but he didn't know for sure. While Corey had been thinking enough to park the van on the other side of the platform, he had not been smart enough to stop at a point that would have allowed them to walk around the side of the structure without putting them in view of the gunman. They had to maneuver Rally back onto the raised surface, and then help him across it and down the ramp on the other side, the same ramp the prey had used when they fled.
"Open the goddamn door!"
Slater yelled as they neared the vehicle. Corey, who'd been sitting motionless in the driver's seat, sprang to action and unlatched the passenger side door. Yates went in first, then pulled on their cousin while Slater pushed from the other side. Given his injury, Rally needed to stay in the seat, so Slater climbed over him, yanked the door closed, and twisted around until he could join his brother in the middle area.
"Go!"
Yates said to Corey. As if to emphasize the order, a bullet pinged off the back of the vehicle. Corey sped toward the path. More bullets hit the van, but they stopped once the vehicle reached the trees. When they came out the other side of the path, Slater sighed with relief and bang! The van began fishtailing.
"Keep us on the road,"
Slater said.
"I'm trying,"
Corey replied. Bang! The front driver's side dipped, pulling the vehicle to the left. Bang! The front passenger side dropped, and they heard the flap, flap, flap of loose rubber. Someone was shooting their tires out. Bang! Now all four were gone. In somewhat of a miracle, Corey kept them from crashing, but he was also slowing.
"No," Slater said. "Keep going."
"The tires are gone!"
"I don't care. If you stop, we're all dead."
The kid stepped on it again and headed down the road to the lodge, the van weaving left and right.
"Damn it, they're not stopping,"
Dylan said. He pointed his gun at the back of the van but didn't pull the trigger. They needed the brothers and cousin alive.
"What's going on?"
"Ananka,"
he said. They hadn't heard from her since not long after the people being hunted had been released.
"Are you back?"
2 minutes from the rendezvous. Give me an update."
As Dylan and Morgan made their way back to the cell building, he and Liesl took turns filling in Ananka. By the time they finished, Dylan and Morgan and Ananka had all reached the building. With Ananka was the Hispanic male former captive.
"Liesl, go find Ricky and Rosario," Ananka said.
"I have not checked the men I shot in the field yet."
She was supposed to provide first aid once it was safe so that no one would bleed out. "Take care of that as quickly as you can and then find our friends, but be careful. I incapacitated one of the hunters, but the other five are still out there."
"Copy."
Ananka looked at Morgan. "I need you to stay here and watch over everyone. This is Eduardo. He'll help if you need it." Morgan nodded and shook hands with Eduardo. "I think the best plan would be to barricade yourselves inside the cell building until we come back."
"Makes sense," Morgan said.
"You know we already have someone locked up in there,"
Dylan said.
"Who?"
Ananka asked.
"The woman working with Rally and Slater. She showed up over here and I led her to a cell."
Oh, if only they were all so easy.
"Tell me about it."
"Come on, you're with me." She ran toward the ATV Slater and Yates had used earlier. As Dylan followed, he could hear Eduardo say to Morgan,
Who are you guys?
The flat tires made the going considerably slower. Slater cursed silently for not having taken the wheel, but knew it was better to let